This is BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0, Germany's economics podcast with Daniel Stetter.
Hello and a warm welcome to my podcast. Every week, I discuss economic issues. And from time to time, I invite guests for a deep dive on a certain topic. If these discussions are done in English, we publish the whole interview in a special edition. Like today, where I had the pleasure to talk to Dr. Bjørn Lomborg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center and author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.
Dr. Lomborg, a very warm welcome on my podcast.
Hey, thank you very much. Daniel, I'm going to call you Daniel, and please just call me Bjorn.
Okay, Bjorn, it's a pleasure. Bjorn, many people would have said to me, well, how could you invite Bjorn to your podcast because he's such a climate denier? And now I looked into your book, and you point out that on an NPV basis, the damage of climate change is around $140 trillion. So this is a big amount. So should we not do something against this, or did I catch something wrong in your book?
Yeah, I guess we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about all of this. It's important to get a sense first of how the debate tends to say everyone who's not saying we should do everything and the kitchen sink to fix climate change, they're climate deniers. I'm not a climate denier. I use the UN Climate Panel as the foremost information on the science. I work with some of the world's top economists in climate. I use the only economist to get the Nobel Prize in climate economics, William Nordhaus, and the $140 trillion, as you estimate, is actually his estimate from his model, showing what's the cost if we simply let climate go its path and we do nothing. The net cost is $140 trillion. So no, I'm not a denier. No, this is a real issue. It is something that we should focus on. But, and that's the answer to your question, if you come out and say it'll cost $140 trillion, but your policy to fix part of this is going to cost $300 trillion, that's a bad idea. It's a little bit like cutting off your arm to cure a wrist ache. You don't actually achieve a net benefit. You achieve a huge disbenefit. And please don't try this at home, right? But the fundamental point here is, again, to say you need to balance the cost and the benefits. And climate is clearly a problem. It is clearly something we should fix. It's also important to say it's not by any means the end of the world, as it's often being contrasted, just to give you a sense of the $140 trillion compared to the total GDP over the next 500 years, it's about 3.5%. So yes, it will leave us worse off, but it's not going to bring us to the poorhouse. It's not going to be the end of the world in any reasonable way. And that's, of course, why we need to have the conversation of saying, look, there's a real cost here. Can we reduce that without actually making more people even worse off? That's an interesting conversation to have. That's unfortunately not the conversation that we're having. And I suspect that's at least partly the conversation that we'll exactly be having here.
Bjorn, exactly. I want to dive into this deeper, clearly. But before we do so, because now already some people might listening to this and say, well, but is it $140 trillion? Isn't it much worse? Because you read all the studies from the climate panel and all the analysts. So what is, just as an update, you know, is it really the end of the world if we have a 4 degrees more, or how will the world look like? Is it, because that's basically the start point, because I have also the impression, if you look at German TV discussions, sometimes, you know, it's if you don't do anything, end of the century, you know, no one can anymore live in Germany or on the world, and you don't sound like this.
Yes. Well, and if you read the UN climate panel, it doesn't sound like that at all. I mean, there's a lot of different things we need to dwell into. But if we first take a look at the extreme weather, which is what many people sort of associate with global warming, extreme weather is, first of all, only some parts are getting more extreme. Some other parts and some very important parts are getting less extreme. So just to give you one example, we know And the UN climate panel tells us because temperatures rise, we get more heat waves. And that will probably also mean more heat deaths. That's absolutely true. But likewise, of course, as temperatures rise, you're going to see fewer cold waves and hence also likely fewer people dying from cold. That matters because if you look at the estimates, there's an overwhelming evidence that shows many more people die from cold than from heat. Now, this is obvious in Scandinavia or in Germany, but it's actually also true in sub-Saharan Africa. And remember, this is because we're actually a tropical species. So the reality here is most people, so globally, it's about 4.5 million people die from cold, about 500,000 people die from heat. As temperatures go up, you're going to see more people die from heat, fewer people die from cold. Overall, over the last 20 years, as temperatures rose about 0.5 degrees centigrade, we know that that actually meant overall fewer people died because they estimate about 116,000 more people died from heat, but about 83,000 fewer people died from cold. In net, 166,000 fewer people died. Again, this does not fit the standard narrative, but that's, of course, because you only hear about the extra heat waves. You don't hear about all the people who don't die from cold waves. Actually, you typically don't hear about cold waves. If we go through all of the different things, and again, there's no way we can do that in an hour podcast, but you can look at, for instance, hurricanes. Are hurricanes getting worse? Actually, we can't see that in the data right now, but we expect what we're likely to see, and this is also what the UN climate panel tells us, there's going to be fewer hurricanes, which is good, but they're going to be stronger, which is bad. Net, that will actually lead to a bigger problem because stronger is worse than fewer. And that's why we probably estimate that the damages will be higher by the end of the century than they are today. But, and this is crucial, because we also smarter, better, we're richer, we're more resilient, we expect that by the end of the century, damages will be much lower as a percent of GDP, but they will be slightly higher than they otherwise have been. That's not a catastrophe, that's a problem. If you look at one more thing, and then I'll shut up about all this, but if you look at one more thing, namely food production, which again is one of these things where people worry a lot. Aren't everybody or a lot of people going to starve because of global warming? No. Again, what will happen is that global warming will make all places that grow food right now slightly warmer, at least on average. And that means they all have to change a little bit how they do things, maybe even switch crops. And that will, all other things equal, make crops slightly less productive. But remember, over the last 100 years, crops have become incredibly more productive because we have put in much more fertilizer, pesticides, and we have much better varieties. We have basically put in a lot of knowledge. That makes them a lot better. Climate makes them slightly less better. And that means by the end of the century, we're likely to see people, actually, we don't have good models out to the end of the century, but by 2050, we estimate that there will be slightly less, much more food in 2050 than there otherwise would have been. Again, climate change makes progress go slightly slower. It still becomes much better, but slightly slower. That's why it's a problem. That's why it's something that we should reasonably be thinking about. But it does not mean, and this is crucial, it does not mean it's the end of the world. Just to give you a sense, right now about 800 million people starve in the world, or about 10%. We estimate that by mid-century, with reasonable assumptions about economic growth, we'll be down to, say, 300 million. Global warming will probably put that up to about 380%. So we will reduce, 380 million people. So we will reduce the number of poor people, starving people, less. But it'll still be reduced much more than what we've seen in the last 20 years. But not quite as much as what we would like. So when you hear these stories, this is the end of the world, you're wrong, you're being misled, you're very often being told one side of a story that is really only one side of the story, a little bit like when you see heat waves over and over and over again, or you see the next hurricane, but you don't hear the combined effort of this impact, which is actually that fewer and fewer people die, that damages are low and lower. Just to give you one final number, and then I will shut up. If you look at the number of people that die from catastrophic impacts that are climate related. So that's floods, droughts, storms, wildfire, and extreme temperatures. We have good data for that, at least for about 100 years back. In the 1920s, on average, every year, about 500,000 people died from these catastrophes. Last year, and that includes the flash floods in Germany and Belgium, and the extreme temperatures and the heat dome in the U.S., and 1,000 people that died from floods in India that you haven't even heard of, and many others. Last year, 6,300 people died. So that's 99.3% less than what died every year in the 1920s. This has nothing to do with climate. It has everything to do with the fact that we're richer, we're more resilient, we know how to deal with many of these challenges. But it challenges the fundamental point that we think we're becoming more and more unsafe. No! Everything in our civilization makes us more and more safe. And climate, again, makes that trend towards more and more safe go slightly slower.
But that's very convincing. But still, you know, coming back to the floods in Germany, we had these floods, and the estimate goes in the range that it cost about 20 billion to repair all of this. So it's a big amount. And you could say, well, this alone cost 20 billion. How can it be that globally we only have 140 trillion in potential damage? So probably some people might challenge and say, probably Nordhaus is too optimistic. Well, we don't. No one knows really, but might be a higher number. But
let me just comment you on this very quickly, because there's a tendency to believe. And of course, when you say it, everybody will say, oh, well, actually, I don't believe that. But I think there is a tendency to believe if there wasn't global warming, there would have been no floods in the world. There would have been no hurricanes. There would have been no droughts. There would have been no nothing. And of course, that's absolutely wrong. Remember, every year, there are a lot of damages. And that was true 100 years ago. That was true probably 1,000 years ago. There's very little people to interact with those damages, and hence we noticed and suffered much less from them, certainly in aggregate amount. But the reality is, when you look at the data of the costs, and we have good cost estimates from about 1990 globally, cost of damages have gone up. But that's because we're richer. Remember, when you have twice as many houses, or you twice as much wealth, or the houses are twice as costly, which both of them are actually true, then obviously the damages from a similar storm or from a similar flood will be, well, either twice as high or even four times as high, right? So you have to adjust with something that actually takes into account your wealth. Typically, you do that with GDP. It turns out that those are very, very good substitutes for each other. That's what you academically do. That's also what the UN tells us. You have to adjust for GDP. If you look at that, what you have is the world in 1990 suffered from all weather-related damages a loss of about 0.36% of its GDP every year. Today, that number is down to about 0.2. It has been declining, and it has been declining in all regions, and for very well-known reasons, just simply because we're much more resilient. And so when people say, oh, here's one catastrophe, that's no good. You have to add up all of those catastrophes around the world and then ask yourself, is that number higher than it was before, or is it lower? Turns out that when you put it in percent of GDP, it's lower, not higher. We've already done the numbers. And that's, of course, why Nordhaus does not say, oh, 20 billion euros, that I have to add in as the cost. No, because there would have been a disaster that would have cost 20 million somewhere. Now, it happened to be in Germany, and that's terrible for those people who are focused there. And you know, when you look at the data, it also seems like a lot of the reason was because there was bad information sharing. So there's bad alarm and messaging systems, and didn't work. And that's a whole other conversation, which is probably much more relevant. And again, why did most of the mayors in the affected areas say it's because of global warming? Because otherwise it would have been their fault. So again, it's understandable why everybody sort of blames global warming, because it's such a convenient scapegoat, but it's actually not mostly that. And we know that the total outcome is we see less damages, not more.
just to help one mayor, or to give just, you know, a credit to one mayor, because he was, when Mrs. Merkel was speaking about climate change being a reason for the flooding, he was saying, well, that's not true. We had already in the past higher floodings a few hundred years back, because they have the track record. And obviously it was not a well-functioning warning system. And obviously houses were constructed in areas they haven't been before, because there were a flood risk. So I think, you know, I got your point. The point is clearly we have to see what the delta is due to climate change. And therefore, let's take this 140 trillion, which is a big number. So now we have a very ambitious German government. We have already for many years, we are over-ambitious in Germany, you know this. And we have several ideas. So one idea of the new government is to speed up the change in our energy systems. You know, we have the so-called Energiewende. And now the goal is to have 2% of the German land basically being used for windmills. So in order to have this. So, and the goal is to basically have a very high share of renewables, 80% already by the end of this decade, in order to cover our power demand. Is this the right way to go? Or would you say, well, you know, it's a very expensive way and probably not justified by the costs?
So there's two things we have to think about. One is that Germany very clearly wants to say, look, we want to cut carbon emissions. And that, you know, fundamentally, that's the right way to think about it. Global warming is a real problem. It's mostly caused by CO2 emissions. So one obvious way is to cut carbon emissions. And clearly, solar and wind achieves at least partly that. So there is some sense in this fundamental argument. But two things. First of all, is Germany doing something that will actually help the world more than the cost the German people will incur on themselves? That's an interesting question. I think the answer is no. We have reasonably good estimates that this will cost a fortune, and it will actually reduce temperatures very, very little. So this is mostly a sort of feel-good gesture issue.
But if it's feel-good and very expensive, so I would say it doesn't help to be feel-good in the long run. It's just short-term feel-good.
No, of course not. And that goes to the second part, which is really, and I'll get back into the numbers in each one of these cases, but that goes to the second part, which is to say, of course, this is not about what Germany does. It's not even about what the European Union or even what the rich world does. Remember, the vast amount of emissions that are going to come in the 21st century will come from China, India, Africa, the rest of Asia, and Latin America. This is not about what we decide to do here. So in some sense, you could argue, and I've seen some of the Greens in Germany make that argument that, well, we want to showcase what a great example this could be from Germany so that everyone else can take care of it. Well, if it actually turns out to be phenomenally expensive, maybe to the point of you getting yellow vest protest in Germany as well, that's not a great example. If you're going to spend hundreds of billions and possibly trillions of euros on a very ineffective climate policy, that's not something you're going to show to the average poor Indian and say, see, don't you want to replicate this? They're going to say, no, we want to stay away from it. So I think we need to recognize if the whole of the EU stopped emitting all emissions, that is, we went net zero today and stayed that way for the rest of the century, using the UN climate models, that would reduce temperatures by the end of the century by 0.14 degrees centigrade. So you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And that's important. This, of course, is not what the Germans are promising. They're promising much less, and it's unlikely that they're going to succeed fully, and it's unlikely they're going to get all of Europe with us. So we're going to have a tiny impact on temperatures. And so the whole argument, if you will, relies on the idea of everybody else jumping along. And that's where we then need to ask, well, what are the damages? We will avoid some damages. And remember, because Europe will sort of be the delta up at the very high end, we will avoid the worst damages. That's great. But this will also have a huge cost. So a reasonable estimate, and this is, I think, a very lower estimate, is the average of all the scenario models that have been done on the UN scenarios. So there's a huge UN climate panel scenario database where they've tried to estimate what are smart paths to net zero and how much will that cost. This is typically measured in lost GDP growth so that we become slightly less richer by 2050 and 2100. And the average is about 3%. So that would be about 180 billion euros per year in 2050 for Germany alone. That would be an annual loss that you would be reincurring every year for the rest of the century. That does not sound unimaginable, but what is important to remember is that requires all politicians to do all the smart things all the way through the century. I think if we look at the current and past performance of climate policy, we know that that's not the case. Politicians love to pick winners. They love to make multiple regulations, that is, both have a carbon tax and also make a subsidy and make a requirement and make some technical recommendations and then also have a permit system which very often do the same thing, but end up, paying one twice, or even four times in a row.
And add to this a taxonomy, because you also ask the capital markets to allocate the money in a certain sense. So this all doesn't fit really together. And the most extreme example, I'm based in Berlin, and in Berlin, the Economist had an article and they wrote that in Berlin, the subsidies for people carrying around stuff on bicycles equals 50,000 euros per ton of CO2. Saved. So you see, this is clearly not an example of. But I'm very much with you on the view around, we should have a relationship between, what we invest and what we get out of this. And especially the German, the German politicians, they say we have to be a role model for the world. We have to show. And there are calculations by the German Industrial Society. They say basically the cost of getting to net zero in Germany is between 2 and 2.5 trillion. Euro, and
over the 30-year period.
Well, over the 30-year period in total. This is I think we will discuss your New Zealand example right away. But what I've done is I just looked at the global CO2 emissions, and I found out that according to data from Goldman Sachs, if I use this amount of money, I could halve global CO2 emissions by tomorrow with the same investment, because most savings cost much less than $100 US dollars to achieve. So. So the point is, what are the big levers? Because you look into, you say, okay, we have a potential budget, I would say, of 140 trillion. Because if you assume Noether is correct, and we say 140 trillion is the total damage, if we invest 139.999, it's good, still a good investment somehow. So, but how should we invest in your view? Because now Germany now wants to have, by the end of this decade, 15 million electric cars on the streets. Is this going to make it? Is the renewable energy push the right one? So in your view, and I know you did the analysis, what are the biggest levers around it to achieve this?
Yes. So first, I just want to round up the last conversation, because I just sort of suggested that this was very costly. So Richard Toll, one of the most quoted climate economists in the world, has actually done a cost-benefit model for Europe. And he finds that the total cost for Europe, so not for Germany, but for Europe, if they do everything right, will still be less than the benefit from net zero for the world. So it's net not a good investment. And that's because Europe is trying to do this way too fast, and it's mostly doing, as you also point out, where the cost of cutting a ton of CO2 is the very costliest. So you're basically buying it at the most expensive price, and you're doing it too fast, so that most of the energy investments, which are very, very expensive, have not been written off yet, but you're actually destroying real wealth. That is probably a really bad idea. He finds that it probably is so that for every euro you spend, you do about 10 cents or less of climate good. That is, you get 1/10 back, or a very, very low return on your investment. Certainly not
a negative return.
A negative return on investment. Yes. You lose most of your investment. So then the question becomes, what should you do? And you're absolutely right in estimating that if we could cut emissions in India or in Africa, we could do this much cheaper. There are two problems with this. One is it's really hard to imagine that we could actually get people to do this. India, for instance, have said they want $1 trillion to start cutting their carbon emissions by 2030. And I just don't see any way that that's ever going to happen. You're never going to get U.S. Voters or German voters, I think, to say, sure, here's $100 billion from the German taxpayer to you guys.
But probably would be smarter than what we are doing.
It would be smarter. The second part is we also need to be a little careful about the idea of saying it's really cheap to cut carbon emissions. But what if that leaves the developing countries in a no-growth situation? That is basically that they can't get their industries going. They can't essentially do what Germany and everybody else has done, get rich on the back of lots and lots of cheap and available energy. And that would be a tragedy not only for those countries, and that's one of the reasons why I think they probably wouldn't take the bet, or they probably would, but they wouldn't actually deliver on it. And the second part is, if you remain poor, you're likely to do a lot more climate and environmental damage in the long run. We know that poverty is the biggest polluter in the world, both very directly because you heat your home with dirty fuels like dung and cardboard or whatever you can get your hand on to cook and keep warm, but also because if you're poor, you will cut down rainforest to just grow some food for your hungry kids. Whereas if you're rich, you'll move to the city and you'll be well off and you'll buy grain on the world market that's produced efficiently at the place where they're best produced. So the fundamental point is it's really hard to go out and say there's some great levers and you can just buy lots of offsets, for instance, in China and India. I don't think that has long-term possibility. The second thing is to recognize, as you mentioned, there are lots and lots of things that most people talk about that are incredibly ineffective. So electric cars is one of them. Electric cars can be a great idea. Look, if you've ever driven a Tesla, you know that it's a fun car. I'm sure that everybody would love it. You should also realize it's an incredibly expensive car. It's mostly very, very rich people that drive around in it. So most people will end up not with a Tesla, but with a little crappy small car. I don't know if you saw that news story from Germany a couple of days ago about this woman who had driven, 650 kilometers, and it was freezing, and she had to turn off the heat in order to preserve her battery, and it took her, 9 hours, something very, very long. And it was just all the way through an unpleasant trip. So look, electric cars are great if you can afford a Tesla and if you have to drive short distances. For instance, if you go to your work and that's like 40 kilometers away, it's ideal, especially if you can charge there. And also if you own a house, so you can actually recharge it on your property. But there's a lot of things that scream, this is a rich man's solution. If you don't live in a house but in a flat, where are you going to charge it? If you have to go far, if you live out in the countryside, if you regularly have to go many hundreds of kilometers, and they are more costly. And when you subsidize them, and everybody does that, and the German government, I believe it's 12,500 euros now, are basically subsidizing them so that every ton of CO2 costs 10 times or maybe 20 times as much as what we could have bought the offsets for. So essentially, we're only cutting one ton for the amount of money that we could have cut 20 tons. That's just silly. That's just dumb. And we do that a lot. So we tell people, you should eat less meat and all that stuff. And sure, I'm vegetarian. I think it's a good idea to eat less meat. But we should be honest about it. It reduces fairly little. So, the best study that we have from Sweden actually shows that if you go vegetarian, you will cut your emissions about 4%, not the 50% that people will often tell you, because that's 50% of your food emissions. But of course, food emissions are a fairly small part of your total emissions. And you also then end up having more money over because vegetarian food is on average cheaper than non-vegetarian food. What do you do with that money? Well, you buy a trip to Mallorca or somewhere else, right? I mean, you actually spend that money and then you blow a lot of your allowance. It probably overall reduces emissions about 2%. Sure, that's nice and you should do that if you're really worried about it, but you should also recognize you could have cut that on the European trading system for about 30 euros per year. So, I think most people would probably choose to say, hey, I'd like to eat meat and then just pay 30 euros. we don't have a good sense of where we can really cut. We have senses of cutting where it matters fairly little, where it's fairly little ineffective, and most of all, where it will have absolutely no impact. And this is why. So we worked together with about 40 of the world's top climate economists, 3 Nobel laureates in economics, to try to find out where can you actually do the most good for every euro spent if you want to fix climate. Now, remember, if you just want to do good in the world, there are many other things that you can do that would do a lot more good for mankind. You know, fix tuberculosis or malnutrition or bad education. There are some amazing things you can do out there, and that's what my think tank works on in my other life, right? But if you want to fix climate, and there's a reasonable argument to do that. And look, we're a rich species. We can actually afford to think about several different issues at the same time. It turns out, don't try to cut carbon emissions right now at very high cost. By all means, put a carbon price. It's going to be hell to actually get it implemented. It's not going to be all that effective, but please do. But this is not the primary way we're going to fix this. The way we're going to fix it is the way that we've fixed all major problems in the world, through innovation. And let me just walk you through that, because right now, you know, we tend to think about, no, you have to put up solar panels or wind turbines. But right now they're costly. That's why you have to force them on people. That's why you have to pay extra money. Otherwise, they would have happened already, and they would have happened across the world. You have to find things that are cheaper and more effective to get people to switch. Let me give you 2 examples. So the U.S., has actually cut more carbon emissions in the 2010s than any other nation on Earth. This is not because of Obama. It's not because of Trump. It's because of shale gas. So some smart guys in Texas and elsewhere figured out that you can frack and get gas much, much cheaper than you used to be able to get it. That meant that suddenly gas became a lot cheaper than coal, and that's why the U.S. has basically switched away from about 60% of its coal. Not because they were worried about environment, but simply because gas was cheaper. Now, the beautiful thing is gas is about half the emissions of coal. So what the U.S. has done is sort of inadvertently, by getting richer, they've probably made about $150 billion per year in net benefits to the economy. But they've also switched to a cleaner energy source. It's still not clean. It still emits CO2. So it's not a perfect solution by any means. But it's a much cleaner solution. That's why the U.S. has cut its emissions a lot. Let me give you another example. If you go back to the 1970s, we worried a lot about food. We worried a lot about the fact that many countries, you know, India, Africa, was basically starving. And we had the sense that there's just more and more people, a lot of people worried about overpopulation. And you know, the sense was, there's just no way we can feed all of these people. I was a little kid back then. I remember my mom, you know, keep telling me, finish your vegetables or, you know, we'll have to send them back down to Africa. I never quite got why that was a good argument, but I think she was more trying to get me to eat my vegetables, right? But the main point was, of course, you cannot solve this problem by having people eat a little less and then sending some of it down to Africa or to India. That's not a long-term solution. And of course, that was not what happened. What did happen was innovation. The innovation that we got from the Green Revolution, that basically meant we found much smarter varieties that grow on the same plot of land and deliver twice or even 3 times as much food. That's how you make problems go away. We simply found a way that meant that every Indian or every African can actually feed him or herself and more. And that's, of course, why India has gone from being a basket case to now being the world's leading rice exporter. Now, there's other problems, and you know, we could get into all of that. You never solve just one problem and completely and all that. But fundamentally, instead of trying to tell everyone, I'm sorry, could you be a little worse off? Could you be a little more hungry, eat a little less of the stuff you like, and then we'll send it down to Africa and India? We found it through innovation. Instead of getting people to switch from coal to gas by saying, we force you, it's going to be incredibly expensive, you will have a little colder apartment because you won't be able to afford as much, innovation made that happen for everyone. The trick here is to use the same approach, and we've done that all through history. We've never managed to get everyone to say, sure, I'll be poorer and colder, but we'll solve a global problem. We've always done that through innovation. That's what we should do for climate change. If we could innovate the price of green energy, and that could be a lot of different things, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in just a second, but if we could innovate the price of one green energy source down below fossil fuels, everyone would switch. Not just rich, well-meaning Germans, but everybody else, also China, India, and everybody else. So the whole point here is to say, sure, there's some other smart things we can do and tinker in the margin, but fundamentally, we're only going to solve global warming if we dramatically ramp up investment in research and development into green energy. If we make green energy cheaper, we fix the problem. If we don't make it cheaper, we will not fix the problem. We'll just be tinkering at the edges.
Björn, that's, I'm with you, but you know, here we have to clarify again, and we have to talk about green energy, because many people in Germany would claim it's already cheaper. Yeah, people say, well, yes, the photovoltaic is much cheaper, windmill, and they say basically cheaper than even nuclear power, so it's the cheapest source. So now some listeners might say, well, what is he talking about? It's already the case. Yes. So but why isn't aren't renewable energies then already now switching over worldwide?
Yes, and that's, of course, the question you have to ask. Unless you have policy pressure, virtually nowhere wants to buy wind or solar or indeed nuclear. And the simple reason is, yeah, sure, solar is cheaper, especially in Dubai, but only when the sun is shining. When the sun is not shining, the cost of solar is virtually infinite. The thing you have to remember is, if you want to have backup power, most people want their power 24/7. If you want backup power, you basically have to buy two energy systems right now. You both have to buy the solar panel, and then you have to buy the fossil fuel power backup system, which is typically gas power systems, which are a little more expensive, but they're cheaper to build. Now, when you run the solar, you don't pay for the gas fuel. So that's right, you need to include that. But people like to compare the whole cost of the energy production with the marginal cost of the solar production when the sun is shining. And that's obviously a biased setup. That's a phenomenally biased setup. And the simple point you need to remind yourself of is, if it was true that solar and wind was cheaper, why aren't we done? Why aren't we just done? Why aren't everybody switching over? Why isn't China and India and everybody else just gobbling it up and buying all of it? And then people will say, but I keep reading about all these solar panels and wind turbines they put up in China. Sure, but that's because it's an incredibly large country. It used to get about 40% of its energy back in 1971, where we start data, of 40% of its energy from renewables. Since then, it's gone down to about, 8% in 2012. And now it's inching upwards from 8% renewables up to 9.5%. So yes, China is going a little bit up, but remember, it gets about 90% of its energy from fossil fuels, just like every other country in the world. So apart from a few very, very hydro-based societies like Sweden, Norway, and Brazil, and a few others, there's a reason why it's so hard to get rid of fossil fuels. There's a reason why the Energiewende has mattered so little to emissions. That's because, sure, you can put in all the solar and wind you want, but you still have to keep all the fossil fuel ready to run when the wind is not blowing, the sun is not shining. And remember, this is not something that happens rarely. In Germany, every year, there's at least 5 days on end where the wind almost doesn't blow. Every 10 years, it's about 8 days. And remember, Germany, and people then love to say, oh, but batteries. Well, yeah, batteries don't really matter. Germany probably have batteries for about 3 minutes of its energy production right now. Europe has for about a minute and a half in total. By 2030, it'll probably be up to 10 minutes. But remember, we need about 10,000 minutes before we're even there where you can handle a 7 day or 8 day streak. And even that is not enough, because then you have to buy a lot more solar and a lot more wind to build up the batteries when the sun is shining and when the wind is blowing. And of course, have that extra capacity so you can run your business at extra power when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing. There's just no way that you can argue that this is cheaper. And one simple way of showing that is, if you look at the number the installed capacity of renewables, so solar and wind, and plot it against the cost of power, you see a very clear linear correlation. And that's not surprising. Look, if you want to be cheap, you just have coal. And this is not a question of saying good things can cost money. That's fine. You know, it's not like education is free. And likewise, cutting carbon emissions is not going to be free. And that's fine because it has a benefit. But we should not lie and say that it's free or it's even going to make us money. No, it's costly. And we should also compare that cost to the cost of how much is that going to reduce our climate problems. And right now we're doing neither. We're just simply pretending, oh, it's incredibly costless or it's even making us money. And we're doing a lot against climate. No, we're not. And no, we're not.
So, but now let's try the following. Let's put ourselves in the shoes of a politician. Let's assume we sit together with Olaf Scholz, the new chancellor. He won the election somehow. He has to deal with the Greens and the Liberals, and he has to run a government, and his main goal in life is to be re-elected. So now we have a huge pressure in the public, in the media, for doing more against climate change. Listening to you, I would learn, or he would learn, that, well, what we currently are doing is not really effective and not, clearly not efficient. On the other hand, going out and say, well, you know, we stop building windmills, we just focus on innovation. Most probably people will say, well, this is typical neoliberal thinking, innovation, who believes in innovation?
Or denier.
Or yes. Innovation deniers, let's put it this way. And then the point is, so what could be now a way out of the box where the European politicians have maneuvered themselves in? Because yes. you have to show the public you're really taking the problem seriously. And that, again, you know, the two of us, we take the problem seriously. But how could we do this? You know, would you say, well, we have the 140 trillion and the European Union has a share of world GDP of, what did I say, 25%, and we take over some from someone else? Because, you know, poorer countries can't afford it. So let's pick a number. Let's say we spend 500 trillion fighting the problem. This is our share of the 140, if you really go for this maximum amount.
Sorry, 50 trillion, right? Not 500 trillion.
Oh, yeah, 50 trillion. No, we have to cut this. No, we won't cut it because it's 50 trillion. So we say, okay, it's 50 trillion, which is still a big amount. So how would we allocate? Would we just say, okay, we build some more windmills in order to do the show so that people see we do something this and spend, then how do we allocate it on R&D? Because it's nice to say R&D should do it and we should spend more money on it, but it's also a question of how to do it. It's easier said than done, in my view.
Oh, absolutely. Look, so first of all, I have great respect for politicians. They are basically tasked with the impossible and making it somehow seem a little less impossible. So absolutely, I totally understand why a lot of politicians love climate. First of all, for a very long time, you could just talk about climate and say, we're going to do it out in the future. Now, of course, the future is here and you actually have to pay up. But it seems like a lot of people actually like to pay up if it makes them feel like they're doing something about it. I tend to think of myself as the guy who simply tries to say, look, I don't think our descendants, our kids and grandkids, are going to, you know, laud us for having felt really good about ourselves. I think they're going to laud us for actually having fixed problems in this world. And so in that sense, I would like to move our political equilibrium, if you will, a tiny bit towards being smarter. In my think tank, we have the saying, we say, you know, we're all about rationality and economic efficiency and stuff. And you know, the sort of presumption from an economist is we should make it the optimal outcome. But that's never going to happen. You know, so our sense is it's not about making it right. It's about making it slightly less wrong. So if we could move the world in a slightly less wrong direction, that'd be great. So absolutely, I think the rational or the no, sorry, the realistic outcome is that we'll build lots of wind turbines, lots of solar panels, we'll waste most of the money, but a lot of people are going to feel very good. We're still going to do recycling and drive electric cars and subsidize them and all that stuff. None of this will matter very much. But then we will also spend a little bit of money on research and development, and that will fix the problem. And then, you know, in 50 years, we're going to say, what the hell were they thinking in wasting all that other money? And there you are. I would like us to spend a little less on the wasteful things, a little more on the smart stuff. The thing I think is crucial to understand is In Paris in 2015, we made this grand deal, which of course actually doesn't mean very much. We just promised stuff that all the politicians' actual policies do not add up to at all. So, you know, it's mostly a showcase of saying, being incredibly hypocritical. But hey, we did this one thing, everybody knows about that. On the sidelines of Paris, Obama and Merkel and many other of the world leaders and lots of the world's top billionaires, including Bill Gates, I'm happy to say we had a very, very, very small part of this, actually met to promise to double their investment in green energy R&D, exactly the solution that we proposed. And it was partly born from the research that I told you about earlier with 40 of the world's top economists and several Nobel laureates. What they did there was actually propose a real solution that could work. But of course, it's not sexy. It's not something that the new chancellor will get much street cred for. And hence, nobody delivered on it. They promised to double their investment to 2020, and it's now past 2020, and we know nobody did that. They increased it a tiny bit. But what we need to do is to increase it, probably we suggest sixfold increase it in total. So we could do much, much more. And the crucial bit is to remember, if you increased it sixfold globally, that would still be just about one-fifth of what we're spending right now on ineffective measures. So you could also put it this way. Right now, the world probably spends, and this is hugely controversial, just exactly how much we spend, but it's probably not unreasonable to say we spend somewhere between half and a full $1 trillion every year. If we say we spend $500 billion a year, we could cut most of that, and we could actually fund green energy R&D, which would cost about $100 billion, save $400 billion, spend some on these showcases, put up some solar panels and wind turbines where people, you know, next to highways so people can really see them and get them on TV all the time so people feel really comfortable about them. And that would actually be a good measure towards fixing much of the problem. The trick here is, and then you asked, how do we do that? How do we actually spend the money on this? And that's crucial. The point is to recognize there are lots and lots of solutions out there, and researchers are incredibly cheap. So let me just get you a few of these. So fission, so nuclear power, basically, is not cost-effective right now. We know almost everywhere you build what's known as third-generation nuclear, so current technology, is incredibly expensive. Typically, and a lot of people would argue, because it is a one-off, you have to do incredible amount of engineering and probably over-engineering, and you just do that one art piece of this one building, one place in the world. Turns out to be very, very expensive. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this. A lot of it is probably because we're incredibly worried. Some of it is also probably because of NGO focus on actually making it so expensive that it's almost impossible to live up to the regulations. But hey, there you are. Fourth generation nuclear promises to be incredibly cheap and much, much safer. So that's basically modularized. You can build lots of them in one go, and they're incredibly safe. They're sort of fail-safe in a totally different way because they shut down rather than run out of for instance, water and then explode like we've seen some other examples of. If you can make this work, this could be one way that cheap green energy could be incredibly accessible. Now, Gates and many others say this will be incredibly cheap, but of course that was what they said about the other three generations. What we should do is invest in the first generations of these, you know, a few of them, see if we can get them up and running. And this is already partly happening, but we can push on, make it happen faster with more research money. Again, there's a good chance it's going to fail, but that's the nature of the beast, and that's where it's important to recognize there are many, many different technologies. Fusion is another thing that, you know, that's sort of the science fiction version of imagine if we could replicate the sun. The saying has been that it's 30 years away, and it always will be 30 years away, which, of course, is why it hasn't happened, because we've been trying this for at least 50 years. But there's a lot of people suggesting, well, maybe now it's only 20 years away. but, you know, we're still worried that it's, and it will still be 20 years away. But it has a potentially amazing outcome, much cheaper, much safer, all this stuff. So again, let's spend money on it. We are doing some, but we could do a lot more. There's a lot of other technologies. Just to give you one example. So Craig Venter, the guy who cracked the human genome back in 2000, he's always been a little bit of a renegade. He has this idea of growing algae on the ocean surface. And these algae would be specifically designed to soak up sunlight and CO2 and produce oil. We know this can be done, but we don't know that it can be done cost effectively. Essentially, we could harvest the oceans for oil, put them in our engines, keep our entire fossil fuel economy, and it would be carbon neutral because it would be in CO2 that was just soaked up 6 months ago out on the ocean surface. This is just one of these many, many, many ideas that are out there. Of course, we should also be investing in the next generations and many next generations of solar and wind with lots of battery. And they have some promise in some places. For instance, in California, the first 10-20% solar is a great investment because it comes right in the middle of the day when you use the most power and the sun is almost always shining. That's typically a very good investment. But the problem is then you keep on investing and then basically the price collapses because the value becomes very small because it doesn't actually deliver the power you need. There's too much power in the day. There's no power at night. That's not a good setup for a modern economy. It's basically just subsidy driven. So there's a lot of solutions that, solar and wind with lots of batteries. If we could get batteries to be incredibly cheaper, we could probably get the Indians to stop putting up as many coal-fired power plants and all this. The point here is we should invest in a lot of different technologies. There are a lot of people out there with great ideas because they cost so little, because innovation costs so little, you can do this for about $100 billion in total. Remember, it's not about putting up $100 billion of solar panels that we know don't work. It's about putting up a few of them that may work a lot better in 10 years.
So this, of course, is a rational recommendation, but let's probably at the end of our discussion, let's be realistic. If I watch our German politicians and if I read what they are thinking when I hear them speak, they say, this is going to be a boost for the German economy. We generate new wealth by transforming to a green net zero economy. And this is, of course, could be very costly. Okay, some people say, the costs are low. So for my former colleagues of BCG, they said, it's just 2% more for every consumer worldwide. I doubt this number. I would say it's a bit more. But let's think it through. If they continue the current path, what's the outlook? And I think you have in your book one example of New Zealand where they did the study. Probably you could elaborate because the probability of politicians now listening to us is not so low, but the probability of them picking up and changing course, I would have to tell you, at least in Germany, my impression is extremely low. So sure. Let's assume Europe continues. Who are going to be the losers of this policy?
So if I can just rewind, I will answer that question in just a second. But I think a crucial bit of this conversation is this the end of the world or not? And that's why a large part of my book is about, is this the end of the world? And it's not. Because if it is the end of the world, if it is a meteor hurtling towards Earth, it should be the only thing we worry about. And a lot of people have this argument. Look, climate change is going to eradicate everyone, so we better get moving, and it's the only thing that matters. And, AOC said it very well. You worry about money when the world is going to end? That makes perfect sense. Of course you shouldn't be doing that. You should just be pushing everything at this issue. I think that's why we first need to get people away from this is the end of the world. That's not what the UN climate panel tells us. It's not what the economic models tell us. When you look, for instance, when you look at the number of people that die from extreme weather, when you look at the people who die from heat and cold, when you look at the damages to the global economy and percent of GDP, they're not going the way you think. They're actually dramatically declining. 99% fewer people die every year from climate over the last 100 years. The damages and percent of GDP has gone down, not up. We should first inform our politicians of that because then we can get rid of this. It's the end of the world. Once it's a problem among many other problems, then we can start having a smarter conversation about this. And then I absolutely believe you're right that the current mode mood, if you will, of people. Oh my God, you know, climate is the thing I really worry about. It's the one that decides my vote and all that stuff. Of course, makes people say, I just want, you know, never mind the cost, just pay up. But that is going to change as people start realizing the cost. And I think today, this year is a good example when prices have gone through the roof. And yes, it is also because of other things, but it's certainly a reminder of what's going to happen when we pursue very, very strong climate policies. This is going to be phenomenally costly. So you asked about New Zealand. New Zealand, actually, it's an interesting case because a lot of politicians, including, as I understand, Germany, has basically decided we're going to go carbon neutral and we're not going to find out how much it costs. At least, you know, you'd imagine if this is likely to be incredibly costly, you would like to find out. But maybe if you've decided you want this, maybe you don't want to find out. To their large credit, the center-left government in New Zealand said, we want to go carbon neutral, but we actually want to find out how much it costs. So they asked their premier economic research institute, they're independent, asked them to find out how much will this cost. They came up with three different scenarios. The average cost is 16% of GDP by 2050. So, you know, just to give, and I'm just doing this right now as we speak, right? We expect it to be $6 trillion. So that would be about €960 billion per year in Germany by 2050. That would probably be an amount that a lot of people would be somewhat uncomfortable
because
paying.
It's recurring. It's not just one time. But
it's recurring. It's every year. Now, remember, it is a lost GDP growth. So in some sense, you won't see it because you're not living in the alternate reality where you haven't wasted this money. But of course, you are in a sense if your countries around you, and especially, of course, if countries like China and India hasn't done it, and they're growing, and they're much better off, maybe even better off than Germany, or certainly on path to overtake Germany, that would probably make a lot of Germans say, I'm not quite sure I like this anymore. There's a huge cost. And once this cost becomes personal, once you start realizing I'm actually paying for this, this means that there's a lot of other things that I can't afford that other nations can afford, and it helps almost nothing. I think some of that tide will change, but absolutely, you're right. Fundamentally, this is a very difficult question to get right. If it was easy to get right, we'd already had gotten it right. If you take a step back, if you think about the world, there's an enormous amount of things that happen in the world that most of us have no idea about. I once talked to a city engineer. If you look at streets going across the street, they undulate up and down so that they actually clear water into the sewers. I never thought of that. How amazing is that? Somebody else has figured this out so that when I walk, I don't actually get my feet wet most of the time because somebody has fixed, you know, the infrastructure so it does, you know, the water gets away. How amazing is that? There are like literally thousands of people every day working on making your and my life in all kinds of ways that we don't know better. That's mostly because this is unpolitical. You know, we've sort of just decided, well, we want the best and the cheapest and the easiest solution to this problem. And then, you know, bureaucrats have gone off and tried to figure this out. What has happened with global warming has become the exact opposite. It's about all of us feeling emotionally being invested in this, feeling like we really matter, that this is an important thing, that I have really helped, change the course of global warming, which, of course, I haven't. But I've certainly helped waste a lot of trillions of euros. So in that sense, we'll never get it right. But I think by pointing out this is not the end of the world, it's a problem. It's actually it's a middling problem out of a many, many problems that we need to fix in this century. And the way that we go about it right now will basically cost lots of money and do almost no good. Hey, shouldn't we try to do that smarter? Shouldn't we spend maybe, I don't know, less money, but much more effectively? So instead of being known as the generation who cared a lot about climate and felt very, very virtuous, that we actually became the guys who fixed it?
Bjorn, I'm sure you wanted to make this a last statement, and I don't know if I still get
that's
five.
That's fine.
We can end it here because I would like to, and it was a perfect last statement, but if you still got 5 minutes, I would like to have a last question because, sure. Look, you spoke about the wealth impact. And funny enough, the German government or the new climate and economics minister starts to talk about abolishing GDP as a measure. So basically, we don't measure anymore that we don't see what we've lost in the future out of these policies. But in your book, you also point out who are the true losers of the current climate policies. And yes, we in the West, we in Germany, we might lose some wealth. But my understanding was the main losers of all our policies are not sitting in Europe, but they are sitting in Africa and the poor countries. Especially also if you think about things like, you know, border taxes in order to make sure that we don't have competition from other countries where they have higher CO2 emissions. So probably,
yes.
What is the damage we, with our thinking, are creating for the rest of the world, for the poorer people in the world? This would be my last question.
Yes. So I'm actually going to answer three or maybe even four questions involved in this. So the first one is, it's true that you shouldn't be fetishizing GDP. I mean, GDP is just an accounting exercise. It doesn't mean all good things. And like people love to point out, you know, if you have an accident, GDP actually grows because you need to build a new car and, you know, you employ people at hospital and all that stuff. So it's not a perfect measure, but it actually turns out that of all the imperfect measures we have in the world, this is one of the best that correlates with pretty much everything we like. And so they've done a lot of other studies.
And happiness. It correlates with happiness.
Yes. Not happiness, because happiness is a very fleeting experience. And happiness correlates actually with very, very few things. It correlates with life satisfaction, which is something that is more long-lasting. Well, it's one of those outcomes of happiness research of the last 20 years that was sort of most robust, because people love to point out as the U.S. GDP increased over the past 40 years, happiness didn't increase. And that's, of course, you know, because everybody is about the same happy every day on average. Yes, you have happy days, but, you know, if you win the lottery, you get, like, you know, 3 months high, and then that's about it. Then you're back to normal. But you're life satisfaction changes dramatically. Your ability to do the things that you want, that really correlates very, very highly. And even when you get very, very rich. So it's not like when people say, oh, but, you know, this is only true for really poor people. Once you get, you know, enough money, it doesn't really matter. And you know that implicitly, because most people don't say, no, I don't really want a raise. You know, they actually would like a raise, would like a bigger house, would like to have better holidays, and like to be able to send their kids to other places that may be more costly, and so on and on. So GDP is a good measure. It's a good thing to actually be wanting. The second one is global warming policies mostly hurt the poor. Now, a lot of people love to point out that global warming hurts the poor, and that's absolutely true, because remember, if you're poor, everything hurts you more. But what we have to be very clear about is that global warming policies also hurt the poor the most. And I'm actually going to answer the question in two different ways, because it also hurts the poor in Germany the most. Remember, the most of the people who say, oh, we should have carbon taxes, gasoline should be more expensive, oh, it's, you know, it's right to have high cost of electricity, are rich people for whom those energy price hikes would matter almost nothing. So there's, you know, in the UK, we have good data for how they, dramatically raised the price of energy. And that meant people started saving energy. Wonderful. Everybody's congratulating themselves. But if you actually look at who saved it, rich didn't save it. Rich can easily afford to use just as much when the cost is twice as high. But the poor had to cut. They had to choose, well, I don't want to heat this room, or maybe I'll freeze a little bit, or maybe we just won't have a light in here, and so on. So it's the poor that end up costing this. There's a wonderful study of the impact. We talked earlier about fracking. The impact of fracking reduced the price of gas. Now, a lot of people, not by any means the majority of people in the U.S., heat their homes with gas. So you had a natural experiment. What happens when gas becomes cheaper? And what you could see was homes got heated much better. That is, through the winter, you were actually more comfortable. And this is not just a question of, oh, it's nice and cozy in here. It actually meant that 11,000 people didn't die from cold every year because of these cheaper gas prices. Now, if you do this in reverse, that is, if you increase the price of heating, you eventually end up with 11,000 people dying every year. Those are not rich people. those are poor people that die, because rich people can easily afford the increase. So this harms the poor by raising the cost of energy, which is one of those basic things that you just have to spend on. So you have to decide, do I keep warm or do I eat? Heat or eat, as they say in English, right? Which is a terrible choice that I'm sure you and I haven't had to have, but many people actually have to have every year. Then on to the real poor, because remember, none of us are poor in the rich world. But the really poor people, which you know may live under a dollar a day, what we used to call dollar a day, in India and elsewhere, they are of course much more exposed. Their lives suck in so many ways, mostly because they're incredibly poor and they're incredibly vulnerable, yes, to climate, but also just to natural catastrophes and everything else. If we could help lift them out of poverty, that could be one of the best things we could do. But what we're instead saying is, no, we're not going to help you get out of poverty, because getting out of poverty means getting enough machinery that you can actually get good agriculture, effective agriculture, or maybe even start production and industrialize. So if you look, for instance, in Africa, and look, what does it really take to get more productivity in African agriculture? Well, it takes pesticides, irrigation, and tractors. And what we're essentially telling them is, you know what? We're going to shave a few tenths of a degree centigrade off the temperature in the by the end of the century, but we're going to make it much harder for you to get pesticides, fertilizer, irrigation, and tractors. That is terrible. It's not only illogical, and it's not only not actually the way to help these people. I would argue it's immoral. And really what we're doing is we're setting up, oh, we care about climate change, and the way to help these poor people is for me to not drive my SUV tomorrow. That's ridiculous. No, the way to help these people tomorrow is to get them out of poverty. And one of the ways, one of the surest way you do that is by getting access to much more and much cheaper energy. This is what most of the world's poor need. And so again, this is of course why China and India and everybody else is going to say, oh yes, we agree with your Paris goals, but not actually do it. And that's of course why they keep putting up more coal-fired power plants. And that's of course also, and that's your last question you asked about what's going to happen with the border tax. Well, I think it's probably going to be avoided by WTO. But basically, the challenge here is if Europe is going to try to make itself green, one of the things it'll have to do is to make energy incredibly expensive. This, of course, belies the whole point of the argument. Oh, it's much cheaper. No, it's not. That's why we have these problems. So we have to make it really, really costly. What will happen if we don't do anything is all the production is going to move overseas. We're all just going to be hairdressers and, you know, do services for each other. And then we'll import everything from China and India, where they'll then be doing all the emissions. Of course, we can't have that. So Europe is talking about making essentially a border tax. If you produce stuff outside that's CO2 polluting, you have to pay an extra tax. You probably can't do that with WTO, but if you can, what that basically means, and we know this from models, is that you're taking your climate cost and putting them on poor Indians. And that's just terrible. I mean, that's, again, immoral. And this goes to show that climate change is one of these funny things where if you just feel and if you just talk in short sentences, it feels like you're doing something nice to poor people. But in reality, what you're doing is that you're doing something that's incredibly elitist. You're saying, hey, we should have subsidies for Teslas so I can get mine cheaper. And you're saying we should make energy more expensive so it'll become harder to live and to be good as a poor person in Germany. And we're certainly going to make it a lot harder to be poor in India and elsewhere. That's bad, bad, bad. That's a lose, lose, lose situation. Oh, and then we're going to make everyone worse off by not being as rich as we could have been in 2050. Again, it's crazy. I also recognize this is never going to convince the chancellor. But again, if we can move it a little bit towards this argument of saying, look, it's not the end of the world. It's a problem. The current solutions are not working. Here's a much smarter one. Invest in green energy R&D. I think we might be able to convince him to spend slightly less on dumb ideas and slightly more on green energy R&D. And hey, then this podcast will not have been for nothing.
Björn, thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Hope to see you again on my show. We might continue this and have a deep dive on some of the other different aspects. But thank you very much. It was a great discussion. And
thank you.
Well, I hope he listens to it, and I hope a little bit of what you said in the end is going to happen.
let's send the link to him.
I will do so. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned because from time to time, as said at the beginning, there will be more English language interviews to come. Best regards, Daniel Stelter.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.